Well, we've come to the position now in our studies on biblical Christian ethics to consider the hot potato of abortion. Last time we did marriage, divorce, and remarriage, and we covered that. And so we come on to the bringing forth of children, which is what marriage is part and parcel for. And, of course, that means that we have to consider this issue of abortion, which for the Christian community, of course, is one of the hottest issues that there is and most controversial issues in society today. It is an opportunity for the Christian community to really speak and show what its values are and the worldview which is the foundation for those values. Unfortunately, many Christians or people that call themselves Christians have been more emotional about this rather than thoughtful about it and doctrinal about it. It's very understandable how one can be emotional. As a pastor, I once showed a series of videos from Stand to Reason Ministries on abortion. I think it was a six-week series, which included, in I think the last but one section, a film about abortions and aborted fetuses and aborted babies. And it was very emotional, sickening in some senses. But we must try to remain as much as we can. I'm not saying dispassionate about it. It's all right to be passionate about it, but we must remain in control of our emotions in these kinds of issues. We have to understand that we're dealing here with worldview issues. We're dealing here with sin. We're dealing with people who do not see the world in the same way that we do. And one of the main backbone arguments of all of these lectures has been that there is a peculiar and particular Christian approach to conduct and ethics, to right and wrong, good and evil, and that we do not have the same view as the world has. Now, some people in the world, maybe a lot of people in the world, do share, at least at the surface, a Christian view of right and wrong, but that's because of the impact of Christianity on America. But it does not go very deep because it's not based upon the foundation of the fact that God has created the world and created us and guides the world. And that's what we believe as Christians. We have His Word, the Bible, that tells us how to live our lives, that tells us how to think. And so we need to make sure that we are in line with the teaching of the Scriptures and that our thoughts are channeled through the thoughts of God, as it were. And in no issue is that more important than this difficult, controversial issue of abortion. Now, I don't need to make a great big thing of the statistics, the figures, but if I can give one illustration, there was a book written in 1981 by a Roman Catholic by the name of Powell, John Powell. I think it was called Abortion, the Silent Holocaust. And he had a chart in that book of war casualties in the 20th century. And he had a cross symbolizing every 50,000 war casualties. And so war casualties from Korea and Vietnam had one cross each. War casualties from the First World War, which America joined at the end, were 2.5 crosses. And war casualties for the Second World War were 11 crosses. Alongside of those, he placed crosses for all of the babies aborted legally, legalized abortion. I didn't say ethically correct abortions, I say legalized abortion, because that which is sometimes legal doesn't mean that it passed the ethical test, doesn't mean that it passes God's test of being true and ethical. There are many unethical laws that are out there, and many unethical lawmakers. But by the time of the book's appearance in 1981, he had 250 crosses marking abortions. So 11 for World War II, 250 for legalized abortions in the 20th century. We're now over 25 years later than that, And so we can put that figure of well over 300 crosses now. We all know about the numbers, the statistics. And, of course, you know, they are, I believe, a complete and utter scandal and disgrace and a tremendously vivid and graphic reflection of the values of this society and the fact that this society has thrown off the Christian worldview in which it was born. But getting beyond those figures, as horrific as they are, we need to address this issue of abortion from the theological perspective foremost, because what God says about it is the most important, then somewhat from the scientific perspective. I can just cut through the scientific material for this lecture by telling you that science is basically in line with the scriptures as far as when the genotype, when the zygote has all of the genetic information that it will ever need, and that if the pregnancy is allowed to come full term, result in a baby. Let me start here by quoting from John Stott, who says this. He says, "Modern medical science appears to confirm the biblical teaching. It was only in the 1960s that the genetic code was unraveled. Now we know that the moment the ovum is fertilized by the penetration of the sperm, the 23 pairs of chromosomes are complete. The zygote has a unique genotype, which is distinct from both parents. And the child's sex, size and shape, color of skin, hair and eyes, temperament and intelligence are already determined." So that's the zygote, okay? And I think the most important thing to notice there is that the zygote has a unique genotype of its own. It is not its mother. It is not its mother's body. It is attached to its mother's body, but it is not its mother's body. Its mother has a genotype of her own, and it is not the genotype of the zygote, the fetus, that she is carrying. This is most important, okay? Fetus, by the way, is the Latin term for offspring, in case you wonder what that word meant. He continues, "Each human being begins as a single fertilized cell, while an adult has about 30 million million cells. Between these two points, fusion and maturity, 45 generations of cell division are necessary, and 41 of them occur before birth." So scientifically, I hope that you can see the continuity that there is once the genotype is fixed. And so as far as when does the zygote become a human being, as it were, well, of course, we have to understand how we're going to define the term human being. It certainly is human from the very beginning, from conception. And then he makes a point from the Swedish photographer Lennart Nilsson's book, A Child is Born, which you may or may not be familiar with. I was familiar with this in England. There was a big splash about this book. It is a book of photographs taken inside the mother's womb from the very start to the end of pregnancy. And it is a book of amazing photographs by this Swedish photographer. And Stott notices here, "At 3 to 3.5 weeks, the tiny heart begins to beat. At 4 weeks, though the fetus is only about 1/4 of an inch long, the head and body are distinguishable, as are also the rudimentary eyes, ears, and mouth. At 6 or 7 weeks, brain function can be detected, and at 8, the time most abortions begin to be performed, all the child's limbs are apparent, including fingers, fingerprints, and toes." So fingerprints of particular human identity, you see, as well as the genotype, you have another identity marker by 8 weeks. "At 9 or 10 weeks, the baby can use his or her hands to grasp and his mouth to swallow and can even suck his thumb. By 13 weeks, the completion of the first trimester, the embryo is completely organized and a miniature baby lies in the mother's womb. He can alter his position, respond to pain, noise and light, and even get a fit of hiccups. From then on, the child merely develops in size and strength. So from 13 weeks, all you're going to get is an increasing size and strength of the baby. By the end of the fifth month and the beginning of the sixth, before the second trimester is complete, and while the pregnancy is not yet two-thirds complete, the baby has hair, eyelashes, nails, and nipples, and can cry, grip, punch, and kick, which sometimes happens after an abortion has been performed by hysterectomy, to the extreme distress of the medical team. Expectant mothers endorse from their own experience their sense of bearing a living child, of course. What Stott is saying there is that scientifically these are the things that we know. And so we don't have any kind of an argument when it comes to the continuity from the set of genes that the fetus has, that the zygote has, from conception to birth. It's the same. And everything is determined by that genotype, okay? So the argument cannot be, therefore, on that basis. The argument has to shift to some other bases. The argument sometimes shifts to mental alertness. Well, the fact that the baby isn't mentally alert, doesn't have, quote-unquote, personality until a certain amount of weeks, okay, say 13 weeks. The problem with that kind of argument, of course, is that it's a slippery slope. You see, if we have to say that the baby doesn't have personality, then we have to define personality. And if we define personality, we need to be very careful, because there are people, even in Granbury today, at Trinity Mission, for example, there are elderly people who do not appear to respond to your questions and to be aware of your presence. And we need to make sure that we, if we're defining personality, that we're including them. Otherwise, of course, can you see that it doesn't just affect the zygote in the mother's womb, it affects people who are breathing the air, that have lived whole and full lives in this world, and we would think deserve our care and attention in their older years. And so I hope you can see that going down the personality route, especially when you're trying to base it on quote-unquote science, is a very slippery slope. It opens the gates to all kinds of things. Surely the best thing to do is not narrow the field to personality, and we'll come back to this, but to open it wider to be more inclusive, and so to include the widest possible group of humans within its purview. Personality, therefore, doesn't really take you down the right road when it comes to the value and the importance of human life. Now, before this, in his book, Stott speaks about the fact that there are a number of examples that are brought forward by those, again, quote-unquote, it's a terrible term, pro-choice advocates. We'll come back to that term. These advocates will bring forward examples. And by the way, the examples that they bring forward do call forth our compassion as Christians and ought to call forth our action as Christians. But he says, consider some examples. An expectant mother is already worn out by a large and demanding family. Their home is already overcrowded and their budget overstretched. It would be financially crippling to have another mouth to feed. The family simply could not cope with another child, or the mother is herself the wage earner, because she is widowed or divorced, or her husband is sick or unemployed. To have another child would ruin the family, or the husband is violent or cruel, perhaps an alcoholic or even a psychopath, and his wife dare not allow another child to come under his influence. Or she is unmarried and feels she cannot face either the stigma or the disadvantage which she and her child would have to endure as a single-parent family. Or she is a schoolgirl or student, and a continued pregnancy would interfere with her education and her career. Or perhaps a pregnancy is due to adultery or incest or rape, and these tragedies are great enough in themselves without adding to them an unplanned, unwanted child. Or she has contracted rubella, or had a prenatal scan and fears that her child will have Down syndrome or be defective in some other way. These are the kinds of examples that are brought forward, and of course, we ought to have sensible responses to them. Of course, they're not all of the same category, are they? The person who is raped, or the victim of incest, of course, is carrying about in her a reminder, a constant reminder of the attack. And if she gives birth, of course, to the child, the child is a constant reminder of the harrowing event that she went through. And so that issue might be placed as an issue to really talk about, pray through, and to consider in a category of its own. Along with it, we might put the issue of, well, it is either a choice between the mother's life or the life of the fetus. Again, that category, because it comes within a difficult decision that has to be made, can be placed again in a category to consider later on. But what about these other ones? What about these ones where there is nothing actually wrong with the mother? The mother has just decided to get involved with a man sexually, and of course, as they are designed to do, they get pregnant. They may be a schoolgirl. But just because they're a schoolgirl doesn't mean they don't have responsibilities. They may have a large family and be in a destitute situation. That in itself, of course, is not a reason to terminate a pregnancy. Now, it may be, again, we're talking maybes here, but it may be a reason to put the child up for adoption. It is not an option to kill the child. These are two different things, you see. With one of them, the issue of abortion, we're dealing with a particular set of values, a particular set of principles which must guide our decision-making process. And of course, we're talking here about Christian ethics. And so how do we do this? What guides us in this? Well, of course, the scriptures are to guide us in this. Now, there's no scripture that says do not have an abortion or abortion is evil. There is a scripture in Exodus chapter 21 where if two men are fighting and the pregnant mother is nearby and is hit by one of the men striving and there is death resulting, then that man will die, life for life. Okay? Problem with that is that that is often used to justify abortion. Now, it is, I think, a pretty gratuitous interpretation of that, which says that the life that is forfeited is the woman's life, not the life of the child that she's bearing. That's how they get round it, you see. And so they say, well, there you see, the life of the child that she's bearing is not worth anything. It's just the woman. Well, of course, the correct interpretation would say, no, if life, the life of the woman or the child, because she's pregnant, she's been identified in Scripture as a pregnant woman with child. And so if life is forfeited on that basis, then life is to be taken away on that basis, life for life. But you can see, although that is good enough, I think, for most Christians, it may not be good enough as an argument for somebody who has respect to Christianity but is not a Christian, the nominal Christian, or the person in the world. It may. That is actually the thing that, if I can speak personally for a minute, decided me when I was asked by some people in my congregation back in England whether their daughter should have an abortion. It was proven by prenatal screening that the child was deformed, and so she was advised to have an abortion. And at first, I thought, yes, that would be for mother and child, that would be the right thing to do. But I prayed and studied, and it was this passage in Exodus 21 that particularly changed my mind, and I straight away got on the phone and called the mother and said, no, this would be killing the life of a child that you are to protect, that God has given to you as a gift, and therefore you cannot have this abortion. I cannot sanction it. It would be a terrible sin. Well, they went through with it. The baby was deformed. And she gave birth to the child. The child was allowed to die, to expire. I can only tell you that although, of course, I had tried to get them to reconsider their decision, that it didn't end there. And it very rarely does end there. Now, for some women who really think superficially and don't care very much about things, they have abortions and they go through them and it appears that they don't think very much about it. But for most women, that is not the case. There are effects. And for this girl and for her mother, who was the prime mover in this, there were large psychological effects afterwards, which I think even today, this is some 18 years later, she is still living with. But I say this to say that that is the text that kind of brought me around. But the best text, theologically speaking, when we're dealing with the issue of abortion, is actually in Psalm 139. And so if you'll turn to Psalm 139, we will go through some of the passages here. Now we know, first of all, that this is a psalm and therefore it is poetic, figurative language. And of course, verse 15, for example, tells us that my frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and skillfully wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. Well, we know that that's not a literal term. It actually is a poetic, figurative term for concealment. So the psalmist is talking about concealment. He's talking about the fact that this was a secret thing. It's God's working in the womb. But let's have a look at this psalm, and we can see some aspects there to help us into a theological understanding of this issue of children, childbirth, and abortion. Look in verse 13, first of all. And in verse 13, we're told, "For you formed," that is God, "you formed my inward parts. You covered me in my mother's womb." Now, first of all, what I want to show you is that the working is not ascribed to some kind of scientific or medical process. It is described of the activity of God. "God, you formed me," David says. "You formed me. In fact, you formed my innards, my inward parts, in my mother's womb." I also call your attention to the fact that David says, "You formed me." There is an identity there, you see, that David is tracing back, not to childbirth, but to the woman's womb. And therefore, it seems from this passage that personhood is that which can be traced back to the fetus. And more importantly than that, it is God's work that we are considering when we're considering the baby in the womb. Now, of course, for the Christian, it is all decisive, and it ought to be all decisive. Issues of personhood or brain scans or anything else or deformities apart, that is the most important thing. It is God's work. So we see, in a sense, a creation of God each time a baby is born. Some of the same thing in Job 10, verse 8, that God's hand fashioned and made him, or shaped and modeled him. You may have a slightly different translation than that, but it is God's activity that we're talking about. In Job 10:10 through 11, "Did you not clothe me with skin and flesh and knit me together with bones and sinews?" And then look at verse 14 in this psalm. "I will praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made." Christians view life as God's prerogative, the bringing forth of life as God's prerogative, and not man's prerogative. This, by the way, is a key ethical issue when it comes to the Christian worldview, as over against many worldviews. Because if you believe that God is not in the process, if you believe that man is a cosmic accident, and though these things just happen, you see, scientifically, naturalistically, these things just happen, then you're not going to bring to the argument any kind of an external moral understanding that is going to guide you into how you value human life. Your values are going to be wrought from just your own opinions or the opinions of those that you read after, not from an authority and a creator higher than the human person. Because life is God's prerogative, then the taking of life is also God's prerogative. And if we keep that as our guiding principle, then of the examples that I read out to you from Stott's book, the family with too many children in a destitute situation, the student who's young and she wants a college and career, these kinds of incidents, never mind the person who just uses abortion as some kind of contraceptive, these things, of course, automatically are met with the Christian disapprobation. They are met with the Christian argument that God brought the life into being. Yes, you were irresponsible, but God brought the life into being, and now that life is a gift and you have a responsibility. But your responsibility does not include the responsibility to take that life. That is God's decision alone. Now, when it comes to the two more difficult situations, then Christians have got to understand that we are dealing here with an ethical dilemma where the value of life is not really the issue. The issue is mercy, compassion, and understanding in the midst of a very difficult situation. So when it comes to the mother, maybe she's a mother of other children, she can choose, maybe, to give up her life, to sacrifice her life for the sake of the child that she is bearing. But we cannot require her to do that. We cannot pressure her to do that. Her life is just as valuable as the life of the child she is bearing. We must never forget that. Remember, there are more issues here than just the value of the life in the womb. Remember what I said about personhood and personality and so on. We have to make sure that we are giving equal value to these lives. And therefore, it is not that the child in the womb is more valuable than the mother, or the mother is more valuable than the child. There's a difficult decision to make. And as Christians, we've got to face that reality and not, with a wave of the hand, dismiss a mother's life as if it wasn't important and wasn't valuable, or that she ought, we say from the outside looking on, to give up her life. No, that is not our decision to make. Whatever decision is made, we have to prayerfully deal with it and help the afflicted. In other words, we need to bear their burdens as we are supposed to be bearing them, and certainly not judging as if, being outside the situation, we had a right to judge. We don't have a right to say what should be done in that situation, only that the value of human life is observed. Once we've done that, the decision isn't over. The decision still has to be made, and it can't be made by us unless we're in that situation. Now, by the way, even the mother does not have exclusive rights to make that decision, because feminists even considered, it is not just the woman's business. The child is not just the woman's child. There's a father. And the father also, and we're talking about, again, this particular situation, this dilemma. I'm not talking about the other ones which we've addressed, I hope. But in a situation where it's either the mother or the child that she's bearing, then the father also, the husband, or today, the partner, because we have to face realities, that's another thing that has to be dealt with by the church, also has a say as to whether he's going to give up his wife, his spouse. And so she cannot make that decision independently of him. Although she has, I think, the right of final say, she doesn't have exclusive rights. This individualism that is the scourge of our Western society must be completely thrown out of our Christian churches. The Christian church is the antithesis of this individualism. It's about community. It's about family. It is about more than the individual. It's about dying to self and thinking of others. And therefore, if any community is to be responsible and act responsibly in such a difficult situation, it ought to be the Christian community that does it. And therefore, you see, the decision is not exclusively the woman's, although I would say the final say has to be the woman's. And what about the issue, therefore, of somebody who is raped? Well, again, we must have compassion. We must have compassion. We need to try as much as we can to put ourselves in the situation of this unfortunate person. She has not asked to be impregnated. She has not asked to be violated. And she's had to deal with the torment of that violation. We must, with compassion, try to help her make a decision that is biblical. I want to turn to Richard Hayes' book, The Moral Vision of the New Testament, here, when he goes through some reasons that are given about abortion and then addresses them. And I want to quickly here deal with them. First of all, first reason, it is inappropriate to set up the issue as a conflict of rights, the rights of the woman versus the rights of the unborn child. In Scripture, there is no right to life. Life is a gift from God. And so when we talk about rights, we're talking the wrong language as Christians. We don't have those rights. We don't have a right to take our life. We don't have a right to do what we want with our life. It might be the language of the American Constitution, but it's not the language of the Bible. It is not the language of God. We don't do with our own lives what we want, and we certainly don't do with another life what we want. Secondly, still less is it appropriate to treat the issue as a matter of the right to privacy, as the Roe versus Wade decision, or exclusively as a matter of individual choice. And he's talking, of course, about the Christian community here. All our actions occur within the community of faith and must be judged by the twin standards of whether they edify the community and whether they witness faithfully to God's will in the world. This clears away a lot of debris, doesn't it? When we start thinking theologically, doctrinally, correctly. Next, the sacredness of life is a sacred cow that has no basis in the New Testament. This is a point made eloquently by Stanley Hauerwas. I quote here, "The Christian prohibition against taking life rests not on the assumption that human life has overriding value, but on the conviction that it is not ours to take." We're engaging in the wrong debate if we're talking about how we value life. We value life because it's God-given. And that's where our stand must be taken. The Christian prohibition of abortion derives not from any assumption of the inherent value of life, but rather from the understanding that as God's creatures, we have no basis to claim sovereignty over life. The Christian respect for life is first of all a statement not about life, but about God. Next reason, it is inappropriate to approach the issue of abortion by asking, when does human life begin, or is the fetus a person? These two things that we've alluded to. Such questions are unanswerable. They're unanswerable because how do you define personality, you see? It is best just to say, no, life is given. A fetus, a zygote, is a human being, and that is it. And we stand there. Even worse is the quality of life argument, which we'll be dealing with, that advocates of abortion by declaring that no unwanted child ought ever to be born. What kind of an ethic is that? As if whether a human person should be dispatched because they're unwanted. You see, it doesn't just stop with the child who is unwanted by the mother. What about after the child is born? What if the child is unwanted then? What about a son or daughter that has an unwanted parent that is hanging on too long? Next, the hypothetical consequentialist argument, that is the teleological one, the utilitarian one, the one where it's the ends that justify the means. The hypothetical consequentialist argument, sometimes used against abortion, is feeble. What if Mary had decided to abort Jesus? You've seen that on bumper stickers. It is a daft argument. Because there's an easy counter-argument, which is, what if Hitler's mother had decided to abort him? You see, there you go. Then abortion's okay then, isn't it? The New Testament, Hayes says, teaches us to approach ethical issues not by asking what will happen if I do X, but rather by asking what is the will of God. From the Christian viewpoint, there isn't a decision to make. When it comes to the teenage pregnancy, when it comes to the mother who just does not want another child, when it comes to the unwanted pregnancy, the decision's been made by the mother in the sexual encounter. And that decision, therefore, sets in motion a responsibility, a commitment. Commitment to be the parent that God wants her, wants him also to be. I want to add a note here about the special case of a person who is raped, and as a result of that, the woman gets pregnant. What about that situation? Obviously, we would all understand that the woman is not in the transgression. In other words, the woman is not the one who has brought this upon herself. She has been violated. She has been sinned against. She is not the one who has committed a sin. The one who has committed the sin is the one who has raped her, and he must bear that guilt and that responsibility. Now, does this mean, therefore, that because this woman has been violated, because she has been sinned against, that therefore, because of the trauma, because of the understandable emotional impact of carrying a child who just reminds her of the violent rape that she is trying to deal with and trying to forget, in a sense, does that mean that she can have an abortion? Well, that is what a lot of Christian ethicists say, and I confess that up until fairly recently, that is what I believed, as long as the abortion was done straight away. My thinking was, on this, just to let you know, that the church does not have a right to do anything but guide and advise and then offer support on the basis of whatever decision is taken. In other words, one thing the church cannot do in a situation like that is dictate that the person has to keep the child. And so on that basis, if a person did have an abortion, then although that is not what the church would like, the church still has a role in supporting that person through the trauma. So that used to be my position. My position has changed. I was never particularly easy with that circumstance, but my position has changed. And it's changed because, as was pointed out to me and as I had come to realize, that was not in line with the doctrine of the providence of God. We understand that evil things happen, and they happen by God's permissive will. In other words, they happen within his providence, on his watch, and many times, certainly not all the time, blessedly, but there are many cases of evil that happen to Christians, and of course non-Christians, in this world. How we respond to them is not just our decision. We must, if our ethics are to be meaningful and have any kind of grounds at all, our ethics must take into account the providence of God and the rights of God, if I can put it that way, or claims of God upon us. And so if a young lady is raped, then, of course, that is a sin, that is an awful thing, and the church must offer support and comfort, particularly, of course, if it's a sister in the Lord. Nevertheless, even though the church, as the church, does not have any right in and of itself to demand that the person violated go through with bringing the child to full term, God himself does have that right, and the church is certainly duty-bound to point that out to the person who has been raped. David Van Drunen, in his recent book Bioethics and the Christian Life, puts it this way on page 165 of his book.
Some Christians become pregnant through rape, and the church ought to show abundant compassion to such women who have suffered a horrible and violent crime, and who may be inclined to abort in order to wipe away constant reminder of a terrifying event. Now on the next page, he writes a paragraph which I think sums up why I changed my mind on this issue, and why I advocate the bringing of the child to full term in all cases. Van Drunen writes this, I hope you will listen. It's a fairly lengthy quote, but it's worth listening to. Christians who show such love to one another, not merely in word but also in action, exhibit a true pro-life ethic. When they uphold their sisters and brothers experiencing burdensome pregnancies and pledge their time and resources to contribute to the care that these children will require, they bestow profound assistance to those who might otherwise succumb to the pressures to abort that society often imposes. Here, in the Christ-like love of the Church, we find perhaps the best answer to the question whether abortion is permissible in certain extreme cases, such as rape or a severely handicapped fetus. Rather than compounding evils by taking the life of an innocent image-bearer, how much better for the members of the church to share each other's burdens? Christians are called to suffer in this life, yet suffering with one another not only lightens each other's loads, but also offers a beautiful witness to what has been called our culture of death. End quote. Here is John Frame and his book, The Doctrine of the Christian Life, page 727. I want you to listen to what he has to say. Certainly, people often seek abortion in the midst of great difficulty, and Christians should sympathize with women who think they have no other alternative. But we cannot compromise the biblical principle that unborn children should be treated the same as those already born. It should certainly be wrong to kill an infant or child because he is deformed, or as a means of population control. So killing an unborn child for these reasons is also wrong. The same, I believe, is true of the more serious issues of rape and incest. We should sympathize with women who do not want to bear children that remind them of such tragic experiences. Such women need much love and counsel. But in the final analysis, we must not kill someone because that person is born of rape or incest. We must not kill a child for the sins of his father. The father is guilty, the child is innocent. In such situations, it may be necessary to give a child up for adoption, though I believe it is best if such a child can be raised by his own mother. For her to undertake such a task, or even to give up the child to adoptive parents, is moral heroism, a great love, but to kill the child is to choose death, not life. Now, in the Van Drunen quotation, we have an emphasis on keeping the child, but on the Christian community's duty to offer loving assistance to help the mother bear this burden. And she bears the burden knowing that even though this evil has happened to her, yet God has allowed it to happen, as he allows all kinds of sins to happen in this fallen world, but God is with her and watching her as she responds to this tragedy. In the Frame quotation, what we have is the important undergirding principle, and that is that this life comes from God. Yes, the child was conceived through a violent and heinous act. And we cannot say that that was the will of God, since sin is never the will of God. But of course, in that, we have also the answer as to whether an abortion should be considered, because abortion is a sin. It's the human decision to take a life that God has given. And of course, this is an innocent life. Therefore, it becomes a sin for the mother to abort an innocent life, even in those extreme circumstances. frame is quite right. We must treat the life of the unborn in the same way as we would treat the life of the born. Only in that way are we approaching the issue of life, and therefore of abortion, with a Christian worldview, bringing God into our decision-making process. God is the life giver, and of course is the only one who can take an innocent life. That is where we must settle. And so that said, let's move on to our next issue.